Acts chapter 14, as we are working through and almost to the end of Paul's first missionary journey. And so last week we touched on that he went from Antioch to Iconium, and then in Iconium he went to Lystra, and that's where we stopped. So when they got to Lystra, what did Paul and Barnabas do that caused a bit of excitement? Yeah, they healed a man who was lame. He had been crippled from birth. And so the people came to sacrifice to them as gods. Who did they think Barnabas was? Which god? Yeah, Zeus. And who did they think Paul was? Hermes. And Hermes was the messenger god. So Paul, as the spokesman, would have been really seen as the messenger. And Barnabas would have been actually seen in that respect as the authority, the one who is directing the messenger there, which we know that wasn't the case. Paul and Barnabas were both messengers of the same authority. And so when they saw the priest of Zeus coming to offer sacrifices to them to worship, down in verse 14 of Acts 14, Paul and Barnabas, they tore their clothes, ran in among the multitude, and said to them, "Men, why are you doing these things?" And then they very briefly challenged them and said, "Don't do this. We are men like you are." And then they go on and they say, and it gives a very short summary of part of their message. It's not the entirety of their message. I know I touched on this last week, but I want to point us to it again just for a second, because we're going to see these same ideas show up in Acts 17. And so Paul's message here is, in the heat of the moment, we're trying to stop you from doing this sinful thing, this idolatrous thing. And so it's very spontaneous, but it's a different approach than he takes with the Jews. I can't say the content of the message is different, but the way that he communicates the message is different. And in one respect, the content is different because he doesn't say everything that he would normally say when preaching to a crowd. He's arguing for a very specific purpose, but it is telling because it's very similar to the content of what he preaches in Athens to the philosophers there. And he goes on and begins to preach the gospel and is interrupted. But he says, first, there in verse 15, "We are men with the same nature as you." And then he says, "And we preach to you that you should turn from these useless things." What are the useless things? Yeah, the worship of the idols. They're useless. They're empty. They're vanities. They're worthless, powerless, dead delusions. And so he says, we're preaching that you turn from these useless idols to whom? The living God. These idols are dead. The God that we implore you to turn to is living. And then he tells us, "Who made the heaven and the earth, the sea, and all things that are in them." So not only is this God alive, what else is he? He is creator of everything. And that's a significant statement because he says he made the heaven, the earth, the sea, and all that are in them. This is one of the things that makes the God of the Bible absolutely unique from all of the pagan gods. So that the great majority of pagan gods were at best partial creators. That is, they took substance that was here, they took and maybe they created man on the earth, but they did not create the earth. It's said of Odin, the god of the Vikings, that his fathers, the giants, were licked out of the ice by a giant celestial cow. And so we have no explanation of where the cow comes from, but you have the chief of the gods. Odin is not creator of all things, but in fact is a product. And you can find similar. You go to Baal in the Old Testament and Marduk in the Old Testament. You go to Zeus. You find that none of them claim to be the creator of absolutely everything. Only the God of the Bible makes that claim. And he says in verse 16, "Who in bygone generations allowed all nations to walk in their own ways. Nevertheless, he did not leave himself without witness, and that he did good, gave us rain from heaven and fruitful seasons, filling our hearts with food and gladness. So verse 17, what is the testimony of God? How does God make himself known to men in verse 17? Yeah, so we have the rain from heaven, we have fruitful seasons, the harvest, we have food and gladness. All comes from God. One of the things we call this is general revelation or natural revelation. Psalm 19, the heavens declare the glory of God. The firmament shows his handiwork. Romans chapter 1, it tells us that men have suppressed the truths of God in unrighteousness, but that they're not without excuse because the things which can be known of God are seen in his creation, even his eternal power and his Godhead. So that looking around, all men can see that there is a creator who is greater than everything. Now, there's a lot that is not included, a lot of details not in that revelation, but that's what Paul is pointing to and saying, look, all that you have comes from somewhere. It doesn't come from a figment of your imagination. It doesn't come from a carved statue. So you can carve the statue 100 foot tall. It's still dead. It comes from the living God who created all things and who orchestrates nature. He superintends creation so that you will see his goodness. And that's the beginning point of where Paul is going to go in Acts 17 and move now to say, here's who this creator is. And this is worth noting, and I'm going to come back to this and say this again in a few weeks, but this is worth noting because we live in a culture now that is much more similar to the paganism of the Greeks and the Romans than it is to the monotheism of Jerusalem and Judea. We're in a pagan world. I think we recognize this. You probably have heard people refer to our nation now as post-Christian. I know you go downtown, there is a shop where they're doing the Wicca stuff, and they're tracing it back to the worship of Mother Earth. There's patterns of thought I'm not going to delve into, but there's ways of thinking now. The way our culture thinks about reality, about truth, is much more similar to ancient paganism than it is to Old Testament religion. And there is value in recognizing when we're talking to people about the gospel that we probably need to go back to, let me tell you about God. Just that simple. Let me tell you a little bit about the God of the Bible. He is creator. I think it is not at all a coincidence that there's still one of the biggest battles for souls revolves around the creation evolution debate. Sometimes one of the most difficult things to help someone get past is the belief in evolution. You see, there is a creator who made all of this. It's not happenstance and a billion lucky mutations. And a billion is an understatement. I don't think we could count the actual number of lucky mutations necessary to make any of us. And so these unbelieving Jews, apparently, they have gone from when Paul left Antioch. They've gone from Antioch, followed him down to Iconium, and there they have met with other unbelieving Jews, and they have chased him out of Iconium, and so he's gone down to Lystra, but they're not giving up. They're not content just with chasing them out of their town. They go now to Lystra, and verse 19, they persuaded the multitudes, they stoned Paul, and dragged him out of the city, which, at least in the text, a minute ago, they're ready to worship him. Now they're stoning him. There's quite a bit of, I'll say, fickleness in the crowds. And there's obviously, time has elapsed. I don't think it was, they put down their garlands and sacrifices and picked up rocks right away, but there absolutely was a time period, but they're changing now. They're not worshiping Paul and Barnabas. They're not believing their message. And so the multitudes, many in that city, are persuaded against them, and their response is violence. And so they stoned him. Now, I want to talk about this for just a second, because there's always questions of, was Paul really dead? And so let me make a couple statements about this. First, stoning was a very familiar method of execution. So when we're talking about this, It's not like you see riots in the streets today and people just pick up rocks and start chucking them at somebody. And, you know, maybe they'll get a lucky hit and hit him in the head and he fall over. And they might think, oh, I may have killed him. That's not what we're talking about at all. They knew what they were doing. And they, generally speaking, were not picking up even fist-sized rocks. They were picking up football-sized rocks that they would have been hurling at him with the intent to kill him. And so they would not have stopped with one strike on the head and he falls down bleeding. They would have continued until they were convinced it was not possible that he could be alive. And in fact, it says, supposing him to be dead. And we read this suppose and think, well, they thought he was dead, but he really wasn't. At least I read it sometimes as more of a, almost a negative statement. This is what they thought, but it wasn't true. What it means is it was a belief. They were convinced he was dead based on a due consideration of the evidence. So they looked at what happened. They have pummeled him with massive rocks. They have seen him lying there broken and bleeding. And so he's dead. And I think their supposition was right. In my opinion, what we're about to read here is a resurrection. Paul is raised from the dead. Now, I will grant that because it doesn't say specifically he was dead, there's still room to argue maybe he wasn't. But I think it's incredibly unlikely, and really I would say it's unbelievable to conclude that they stoned him and watched and said he's dead, but he really wasn't. And so they stone him, drag him out of the city. Verse 20, when the disciples gathered around him, he rose up and went where? Into the city. It's not that Paul got up and immediately hit the road and just said, I'm never going back there. I don't understand this kind of audacity. I really don't. It's amazing. They have dragged him out. They've stoned him, dragged his lifeless body out, thrown him outside the city like he's garbage. And the disciples are there gathered around. Paul stands up, which that had to be astonishing in itself. And then he goes back into the same city. Now the next day, he and Barnabas left for Derbe. But the way it's worded, they're not running. They're not fleeing for their lives. They're not hiding. They're just continuing their journey. And I was actually listening to a friend of mine, and some of you know the McMullen son-in-law, MJ. He was actually preaching this same chapter last Sunday. So our teaching and preaching dovetailed a little bit last week, but he made a good observation about this section here. You go back to verse 14. How are Paul and Barnabas responding? How would you describe their emotional state? They're tearing their clothes, running amongst them, distressed. Verse 20, how would you describe their emotional state? Yeah, as far as the text tells us, okay, it's another day. Time to go to the next town. They are cranked up about idolatry, and rightfully so. They're not that bothered about being killed. They have a perspective of life, of ministry. Frankly, it's one we need again. It's one that we have lost in our culture. We don't think it worthwhile to die for Christ. We hear of a missionary. Probably you all remember the guy, I think it was down in Indonesia, but somewhere in that portion, Southern Asia, somewhere down that neck of the woods, this one young man, 20-something young man, decided he was going to go to this one island where there was never been reached with the gospel. They were known to hate outsiders, and he decided he was going to go there and preach the gospel to them. But very quickly, he was killed. And I don't think anybody or very few Christians looked at it and said that was worthwhile. I heard a lot of, why? Why would he do that? What a waste. Couldn't he have gone, found a better way? Couldn't he have gone somewhere else? Did he need to do that? And I'm not going to get in the ins and outs of that situation because I don't know enough about it to actually argue how well he planned and all of that. Except to say that whole section, that whole event was a bit revealing to me because of how many people just looked at it and said, why would you do that? And no thought of, it may be worthwhile to die for Christ. It may be worthwhile to be killed. There's a book. I wish I knew what the book was about. All I know is the title. I love the title. You Will Be Eaten by Cannibals. It's a missionary book. And the book is not, what I know of it anyway, it's not discouraging missions. Not at all. But rather the idea of the great missionaries has been, it is worthwhile to lose it all for Christ. Do we have anywhere in the New Testament that might back up that idea? Stephen. Who was converted after Stephen's death? Saul of Tarsus, this young man standing there consenting unto his death. He is enraged initially, but is ultimately converted. And the way that Acts is laid out, I think it's intended for us to see some connections between the death of Stephen and the conversion of Saul. We go back into the Gospels. Christ himself has said repeatedly, if you do not forsake all and follow me, if you do not take up your cross and follow me, you cannot be my disciple. You get to the end of Hebrews chapter 11. With the descriptions of people who lived in caves and dens of the earth, who were executed, sawn in half. Their parents saw their children killed. It describes at the end of this great hall of faith, it gives us this brief couple verses of statements of what else they did. What else these great believers did. In Hebrews 10 verse 38, it says, of them of whom the world is not worthy. You go to the book of Revelation and we find the story of the saints who are martyred during the tribulation, and they received great praise and great reward from God because they loved not their lives even to the death. Absolutely, the New Testament perspective of Christian living is that our life, our survival is not that significant. There are far more important things like idolatry. Like pagans dying and going to hell. There are things that matter so much more than survival or simply even having a comfortable day. Imagine this day of rocks chucked at your head was not comfortable for Paul, but it didn't matter because for to me to live is Christ and then to die is gain. He says the same passage, I am in a strait betwixt two. I'm on the horns of this dilemma. Because I want to depart, which is far better. And speaking of going to heaven, it's far better than remaining. He says it's needful that I remain. That perspective that we read about in the Pauline epistles is modeled for us. Paul wasn't just talking. This is how he lived. And this is how he died. And it was worth it. Every bit of it was worth it. So, verse 21. They go to Derbe. And when they had preached the gospel to the city and made many disciples, doesn't say a whole lot about it, just simply that they preached, many were saved, many began to walk in obedience, and it doesn't say anything about Jews following them down or anything. So why he says so little about this, we don't know, but simply they were there in Derbe, preached the gospel, people were saved, then after that they returned to Lystra, the same city. And then they went to Iconium, where they'd been chased out of town. And then they went to Antioch, where they'd been chased out of town. Verse 22, strengthening the souls of the disciples, exhorting them to continue in the faith. So they plant these churches, and then they go back. And so there'd be weeks to months between visits. There's not enough information here to know how long he spent in Derbe. But at the very least, you have several weeks. So they go back then to Lystra, then Iconium, then Antioch, and encouraging the believers and exhorting them, saying, don't give up. Don't jump ship. Continue. You profess this faith. Continue in it. And here are their words of encouragement. We must, through many tribulations, enter the kingdom of God. You're not really going to put this on a Hallmark greeting card. But these are the words that Paul tells these believers. Remind you again, what happened to Paul in Lystra? He was stoned. What happened to Paul and Barnabas in Iconium? They were chased out of town. What happened to Paul and Barnabas in Antioch? They were chased out of town. Do you think if Paul's going to be at all credible if he shows back up in Lystra and says, you can have your best life now. Jesus has a wonderful plan for your life. They're going to say, what were you smoking in Derbe, Paul? Because that's not what happened here. They're going to look around at their life because Luke does not say this. I think it is reasonable to conclude that at the very least, some of these believers in Lystra and Iconium and Antioch were being persecuted. that may not have been being executed or even imprisoned, but there's every reason to suspect that they were facing intense opposition from family. They may have lost employment. Certainly many of the early believers would have been slaves and so may have suffered at the hands of their masters. It would not have been just this easy, comfortable Christian life for them. Their Christian life would have put them outside of their society. They would have been recognized now as something less than everybody else. And possibly, this certainly happened later, they may have been recognized as those who were actually opposing the good moral order of the day. Because they would have now been opposing the religion of that city, which bound that city together. And they absolutely believed that if they did not offer the sacrifices to the gods, they did not make the prayers to the gods like they should, then they would not receive the rain they needed, the bounty of crops that they needed. They believed that if there was no appeasing of the god and appeals to the gods, then there was going to be consequences. The gods would overlook them and forget them. And so if you have a group of people that have been participating in this and now they back off, it's not a tolerant society and pluralistic society where you can all believe what you want to believe. No, if you stop worshiping the gods, you stop offering sacrifices to the gods may ignore you or worse, they may get angry. And if there are bad things that begin to happen in those cities, I can tell you the first person to be blamed for it are going to be the Christians because they've stopped worshiping the gods. And so Paul's exhortation here is that we must, through many tribulations, enter the kingdom of God. It is a necessary, realistic exhortation that following Christ will be costly. It will be full of tribulation. You are going to be opposed by the enemies of Christ. If they hated him, how much more will they hate his servant? These are the words of Paul, and I know we have lost sight of this. Certainly, I'll say broadly speaking, in American Christianity, we don't think this way. There seems to be more and more beginning to come to this realization as we recognize more and more hostility in our culture to Christianity. I trust you recognize that that has been building, and I fully anticipate it continue to grow, this hostility to Christianity, so that we are now identified by many as hateful and bigoted. And it shouldn't surprise us, but it obviously does many times. And it certainly, most importantly, should not cause us to change the message in any way. We do not need to start tweaking Christianity to make it more appealing. We need to preach it because in itself is powerful. And so I'm not going to keep going there. I could, but I won't. So then verse 23. So when they had appointed elders in every church, I'm going to make one comment on that phrase, because as we're reading through the book of Acts, we bump into this question of church government. And a big one is, you know, one pastor or a group of lay elders or group of elders. And this, as well as several other passages in Acts, are used to say, see, they appointed elders, notice the plural, in every church. So you read it in English and it sounds like plural elders in singular church. What it actually says, I'm going to go into the Greek with this, but this is from the Greek, it just simply says they appointed elders throughout the churches. It's a very different statement than they appointed a plurality of elders in every single church, but rather that they appointed elders, plural, throughout the churches, plural. And so you can't argue for a plurality of elders from there, is what that gets down to. They appointed elders, prayed with fasting, and they commended them to the Lord in whom they had believed. So what they did, they go back to these churches and they're strengthening them. They're strengthening them with exhortation, encouragement, as maybe discouraging as encouragement may sound to us. They're encouraging them. And then they're establishing them with proper government. They're giving them a church polity, how the church operates. They're giving them godly leaders to help strengthen them to continue in the faith. And so verse 24, after they had passed through Pisidia, they came to Pamphylia. Now when they had preached the word in Perga, they go over to Attalia, and it is from there that they sail to Antioch. So they would have gone back to the port town of Seleucia and then traveled that distance over land to Antioch. Verse 26, from there they sailed to Antioch, where they had been commended to the grace of God for the work which they had completed. Now when they had come and gathered the church together, they reported all that God had done with them, and that he had opened the door of faith to the Gentiles. So they stayed there a long time with the disciples. And this really becomes a model of how we respond to and how our missionaries respond to us. We see the church in Antioch commending them to the grace of God for the work. When we send out missionaries, that's part of what we're doing. We don't have any missionaries here that have been sent out where we are. There's what's called sending church. But every missionary that we support has a sending church. That is the church that they were members of or should still be members of, and that has done this, commended them to the grace of God to send them out to do the work. And then the missionaries return and report to that church what God had been doing. And in the case of modern American missions, because a large number of churches support a missionary, all of them have a little part of supplying the monthly needs for those missionaries. When they come back, they report to the churches that support them, the ones that help them in this work, to tell this is what God had done. And so this is part of the reason we do what we do with our missionaries. So it's part of the reason when we have missionaries home on furlough, I make it a priority to bring them here. And in fact, I tell them, essentially, tell me when you can be here. We'll make that Sunday available. And so we try to do it as much as we can. Just look, be here. We'll make it happen. Because of partially this principle of them reporting to those that have sent them out to do the work of the ministry. And it says, verse 28, they stayed a long time there with the disciples, just a kind of a general reference Luke makes, and just another marker of time, that they were there a little while. Don't know how long that long time is, but they were there a little while. And that brings us to the end of the chapter and actually sets up the conflict that we're going to see in chapter 15. Acts 15 is a major, major chapter. Not just in the book of Acts, but in Christianity still. It's vital to us today.